O'Connell said, brightening. I'll get right on it. Just outside the wire fence that marked the perimeter of the Astro facility, Rick Chatham was giving instructions to his volunteers. Most of them carried placards professionally printed in red, white, and blue. Stop the power set. Don't microwave the world. Space is for science, not profit. When the TV trucks come down this road, he said, pointing with an outstretched arm, we've got to swarm around them, wave our placards in front of their drivers so they have to slow down and stop. We can lay down on the road, a balding, overweight man in khaki shorts called out. Then they'll have to stop. If that's what it takes, that's what we'll have to do, Chatham agreed. Make them stop and turn their cameras on us. Make the world see what's going on here. That's right, said Chatham. We're going to make the world realize that what these industrialists are trying to do is evil. They're stealing energy from the sun and beaming intense microwaves down to the ground. They're threatening to upset the balance of nature and destroy our environment.
We've got to stop them,
a woman cried out earnestly. Remember, we're on state-owned land here, Chatham said as loudly as he could. We have a perfect right to be here. And if they try to force us out, they're breaking the law, not us. On the other side of the gate, a quartet of uniformed security officers stood by uneasily. They wore no guns, but each of them carried a fully charged cattle prod strapped to his hip. A fifth officer, wearing a sergeant's stripes on her sleeves, stood scowling at the group of volunteers gathered in the road. Once Chatham finished his little oration, she called out to him,
Sir! May I speak to you for a moment?
Chatham ambled over toward her, leaned one arm on the wire mesh of the gate.
You've got a legal right to demonstrate, the sergeant said, on that side of the gate.
I know that, said Chatham. That's the law.
Right. But if your people try to cross over the property line once we've opened this gate, that's trespassing, and we are under orders to deal with trespassers.
Chatham smiled lazily at her.
All five of you? How could you stop us? I've got more than 100 people here. A detachment of state police will be arriving on the first ferry, sir, said the sergeant. And if you put one toe on this side of the gate, I'll make it my personal business to split your skull open.
She smiled sweetly at him.
Asim al-Bashir drove his rented Mercedes off the ferry and passed the line of cars that seemed to be waiting at the edge of the parking lot. Behind him, a long black limo with a State of Texas emblem jounced across the ferry's ramp and onto dry land, followed by a heavy TV van bristling with antennas. Al-Bashir saw one of the waiting autos cut in front of the limo. He watched in his rearview mirror as a young man got out of the car and started talking with the chauffeur. The TV van stopped behind the limo. Cars waiting behind the van bleated their horns angrily. Wondering what that was all about, Al-Bashir leaned on the gas pedal and sped down the main road toward the Astro facility. The limo, he noticed, turned off on the side road, led by the unmarked automobile, and the TV van followed it. As he neared the Astro complex, Al-Bashir saw that a crowd of people was blocking the road. He slowed down and saw that most of them were carrying colorful placards. Demonstrators, he realized. Ecology fanatics trying to block the gate. Al-Bashir knew how to deal with demonstrators. He slowed the Mercedes to 10 miles per hour and kept boring straight ahead. They waved their placards in front of his windshield and yelled at him. He couldn't hear their shouted curses through the car's luxurious insulation. Smiling tightly, he edged the car through the angry crowd. The Astro guards had opened the gate and he inched through. None of the demonstrators tried to get through the gate, and a woman in a sergeant's uniform threw him a salute as he accelerated past her. Al-Bashir laughed to himself as he headed for Hangar A. What if we turned the power sat beam onto this spot, he thought idly. What if we cooked those demonstrators where they stood? How poetic. What a sensation that would cause. But he commanded himself to be serious. You have more important victims to deal with than a ragtag band of do-gooders, he said silently. And besides, you don't want to hurt Dan Randolph. He is the real enemy, the devil incarnate.
He must die, and his satellite with him, if we are to win. But not until we strike. Randolph has to be alive to be the focus of the people's wrath after their president is killed. Then he thought of April. You don't want to hurt her, either, he reminded himself. By this time tomorrow, she'll be flying to Marseille with you. She'll actually be safer with me than here when the mobs start to tear this place down to the ground.
Near-Earth Orbit. Williamson's stomach still churned queasily, and his head felt as if it were stuffed with snot-soaked tissues. He tried to keep perfectly still, strapped into the couch of the Soyuz spacecraft, like three corpses wedged into a metal bucket, he thought. The Russians said it would seem bigger once we got to zero gravity, but it still feels like a bloody coffin in here.
You okay? Nikolaev asked. Before Williamson could think of a reply, Buchachi groaned, I believe I'm going to die. Nikolaev laughed. No, you won't die. You might want to right now, but in few hours you'll feel better. By time we make rendezvous, you'll be okay to get up and move around.
Williamson realized he was hearing them through the headphones in his sealed helmet. The Russian had turned on the intercom system.
Everything is fine, Nikolaev assured them, pointing with a gloved hand to the curves on the display screen before them. We are on track for rendezvous with transfer ship. In 2 hours, 18 minutes, we go to transfer ship waiting for us. Then we ride out to PowerSat. Then I sit and wait for you while you go outside and fix satellite.
No, Williamson countered silently. Once we reach the PowerSat, I kill you, you stupid Russian bastard. If he hadn't felt so sick, Williamson would have smiled.
We should have hired a band, Dan said to April as they stood at the base of the airstrip's control tower, watching Scanwell's private jet make its final approach.
Wind's picking up, he noted, watching the distant trees tossing. We're going to have to turn on the power sat in the middle of a rainstorm.
April squinted up at the darkening clouds piling up in the sky and said nothing. Dan wondered if she were nervous, worried, or just tired. Probably all three, he decided.
Al-Bashir stood at her other side, chatting quietly with the representative that NASA had sent for the occasion.
A brass band would have been a nice touch, Dan said to no one in particular. He was talking to cover his own nervousness, and he knew it.
We could have had them play Hail to the Chief when Scanwell gets out of his plane.
April said softly,
He isn't president yet.
Forcing a grin, Dan replied, Well, he's still governor of Texas. We could have played The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You, or something like that. That brought a smile to her lips. Dan felt better for it. 8 TV trucks were lined up in the parking area, their cameras tracking Scanwell's approaching jet. Dan turned the other way and saw the booster standing on the launch pad, with the space plane sitting atop it. Ready to go, he thought, just like a Minuteman. I only hope we don't need it. The business jet touched down with a screech of tires and rolled to the apron where Dan and the others were waiting. News reporters surged toward the plane. Dan congratulated himself that none of the TV vans had been accosted by the eco-nut demonstrators. His little detour had worked. The plane's hatch swung open, and Morgan Scanwell appeared at the top of the stairs, tall and rangy, smiling confidently, waving to the crowd, which was mostly news media people. Vicky Lee was among them, Dan saw, representing Aviation Week. He wondered if she planned to stay overnight, and if she did, what he would do about it. Jane followed Scanwell down the plane's stairs, looking splendid in a soft green-skirted suit. Regal, Dan thought. That's the word for her. She should be running for president, he told himself. She'd be much better at it than he would.
Nacho Chavez looked decidedly unhappy, Emmons thought. Not angry, not frightened, just plain unhappy, miserable. Like a little boy who got caught doing something naughty.
The regional director, on the other hand, looked outright furious. She sat behind her desk like an enraged gnome, anger radiating from her frowning, hard-eyed face. A hell of a way to spend a Sunday morning, Emmons had to admit.
You implanted a tracking beacon on her body? The director growled.
I did it,
Eamon said. Agent Chavez didn't know about it until